This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have with us Dr. Bruce Lipton. How are you, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely wonderful, Eva, and thanks for this wonderful opportunity as well.
Oh, man, thanks so much for coming on, especially on a holiday.
Well, it's a good time to talk about this consciousness as any time.
Well, I would do a long introduction on you, but I know everybody knows who you are because you were on a few months ago. And we got off topic, so I want to give you all the time that I can. Tell us, you can give us your website and your contact information, and then let's talk about your book, Biology of Belief, and anything else that comes up on the radar.
Well, that's a pretty broad topic. Let's narrow that down.
I got a list of questions.
All right, we just start with a question, and then, of course, we then are legally bound to, you know, stray off the question and go elsewhere. Okay.
Of course, they're all out of order. So your website is what?
BruceLipton.com. Very simple. It's got a lot of wonderful resources. You can download free information, especially about the topics we'll be talking about, and a lot of links. And it's just it's filled with a lot of information about what I guess we're referring to as New Age science.
So your background, you're a biologist, but you're what kind of specific biologist? I know you have some specific training.
Yes, I got. I'm a developmental cellular biologist, which is a complicated way of saying I like working on why cells work and how they work and what happens when they don't work well. And
so,
I got my training at the University of Wisconsin where I was doing research on cloning stem cells, which I always enjoy because people think that stem cells are a relatively new thing that has come into our consciousness. And I was cloning stem cells for my PhD degree starting in 1967. So that was about 40 years ago, cloning those babies. And what was so profoundly important is the research that I did during my graduate study expanded subsequently when I was a professor in the anatomy department at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. And when I was there, I expanded on the stem cell work and found some things that were so exciting and yet so contradictory to what I was teaching medical students that I was in a real bind for a while because I realized that the information I was teaching students about genetic control in those days was totally wrong based on the experiments that my stem cells were revealing different kinds of results totally. And so ultimately I resigned my position at University of Virginia, went out on my own. A little hiatus, you know, some people like between fabulous meals you have a little sherbet glass and you can rinse the palate, a little sherbet. I rinsed my palate from the University of Virginia before later going to Stanford producing a rock and roll show. And I found a musician in Chicago and took him out of school, and his name is Yanni. And we got him on the road and started shows. And then when I lost everything I earned and owned because being a professor, totally unfamiliar with the ways of the road, I came back into academia and had an opportunity to go to Stanford University School of Medicine, where I was a research scientist, and again extended my work on cloning stem cells. So that's my academic pedigree, so to speak. I left Stanford around 92. Because the information that my work was revealing was so antagonistic to the conventional wisdom that it was very difficult to stay in the field with all those people around me trying to squeeze me out or less. And it was so exciting because I went out on my own and now I can happily sit here today and say that my lectures in 1985 on this new biology are now, if somebody heard them in the leading edge of science today, they say, so what's new? So it's just been wonderful because the research provides an understanding that was so powerful and so affected me that I really couldn't stay in integrity by staying in academia because I saw that we were misprogramming our students and providing misperceptions to the world and community at large. And that when I understood the nature of these misperceptions and the influence they have on people's lives, I was so shocked by what I was doing. I just left the system and tried to now bring a new insight into the world. And it's, as I said, over the last 20-some years now, the research I was talking about has become leading-edge science. And so what are we talking about, Eva? We're talking about this. When I was teaching in medical school and teaching the students the nature of how biology was influenced by the genes, and the genes were the predominant controlling factor, I was teaching a notion of victimhood, that people are victims because, as far as we know, we didn't pick the genes we came with, and we can't change the genes, and the genes control our traits, then all of a sudden you realize that your life is essentially programmed by these genes that you don't have any say over, and they have a say over you. So that leads to a belief of our health being out of our hands, and that we're sort of like frail, vulnerable mm-hmm. biochemical robots. So that was what I was teaching. And medical doctors, of course, when an individual finds themselves a victim of life, such as their genes are not supporting them, then we look for rescuers. And so victims require rescuers, and the rescuers provided for the medical industry that we have today. Yes.
I believe everything that you're right. But I want to ask a question. When someone doesn't get healed, what does that mean?
When someone doesn't get healed...
And they're trying.
Okay, and they're trying, then we have to look at a couple of different situations, okay? We'll go to the biggest and grossest one of all, the biggest issue that might be involved at some point. And it's related to this biology, which really blew my mind because I never believed in spirituality. And yet, what the new biology and the stem cell research revealed is that our identity is in the field and plays through the cells, and that our bodies are more or less like a virtual reality machines. We step into our body and we sense the world through our mm-hmm. nervous system. And why was this important is because it led me to understand that our identity and each of our identities is an information in the field around us, which blew my mind because I got into science avoiding spirituality and then looked at the molecular model and the math behind it and said, oh my God, the identity is not in the system, period. And that led me into understanding the nature of the field and the interaction with the cell. So long-winded prelude, but it's very important, is that we have a spiritual existence and a material existence. The material one comes and goes, and the spiritual one is more or less part of the permanent fixture of the field that we live in. And the significance is that we come into life and we go out of life and we come back into life on a number of different times. And that we also can see that our biology, this body that we get into, responds to the field because that's how we experience what the body experiences, because we're part of that field and the body is communicating with the field. So that says that our life experiences influence the field of our identity, which is a spiritual identity for most people. And the significance of that whole thing comes down to the concept called karma. So right away it says what we've done in our history has altered the field to a certain degree, so every time we come back, we've altered the field in a previous existence, and so there's a balance, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But this is really cool because the concept of karma can be totally resolved when we become fully conscious, and that's because we create our own reality. And this is quantum physics speaking, not just Bruce here. So the significance of that is that perhaps some of the issues in this life are really some consequence of previous existence. Now, I'm not saying that's the big thing. In fact, maybe that's the small influence. But here is what I think might be the big influence of why people don't get healed. Because healing, when we talk about it, is usually a conscious intention. A person doesn't feel well, they've got a problem, they've got a disease, and they're consciously aware of it, and this consciously says, I don't want this, I want something other than this, and I don't want this. And that's a conscious aspiration. Now, why this is important, as my book, The Biology of Belief, describes, that the cells in the body are programmed by the perceptions of the mind. And the significance of that is as an organism moves through the environment, it perceives the environment and interprets what's going on and then adjusts its biology to stay alive. So that the biology on the inside of the body is connected to the environment with the interface being the brain and the mind. And so what we talk about the mind is our interpretation of what's going on in the world. Well, there's two parts to the mind, and this is, I think, if there's the most, I'm glad you brought this up, and I'll get to it.
It's okay, I'm quite happy.
This is a, perhaps one of the most important points that if we just dealt with this, it'd be great, and it goes like this. There are two minds that are involved with controlling the biology of the cells. And this mind can control the behavior and the gene expression and the physiology and every aspect of our biological mechanism. So the mind plays the most important pivotal role in the expression of the body. There are two minds that cooperate with each other. One of them we're familiar with is the conscious mind, which is the one associated with our identity, our spirit, if you want to say that, our source. The conscious mind is the one that is creative. It has our wishes and our desires, our aspirations, what we want from life. Those are aspects of the programming or aspects of the conscious mind's function. And then we have the subconscious mind. And the subconscious mind is more or less a machine. It's basically a record system that records experiences, and then when you push a button, it plays back the learned behavior in those experiences. And as a result, in one sense, you can consider the subconscious mind like this giant jukebox. And all these records are on there, records of our experiences and responses. And that when you push a button, we'll play that behavior automatically. And the subconscious mind is a very powerful mind compared to the conscious mind. Subconscious mind is a million times more powerful as an information processor than the conscious mind. And neuroscientists have now recognized, and here's the catch, people got to listen to this, here's the catch. The subconscious mind works 95 to 99% of the day for us, meaning the subconscious mind is essentially controlling our lives 95 to 99% of the day. Now, here's the disconnect. The conscious mind, again, is our creative mind with our desires and our wishes and whatever we want in.
Where does ego reside?
Okay, the ego will be part of the conscious mind and the spiritual self.
Okay.
But right now, so we're going to talk about the mind is controlling the body. What we want in our personal lives, when you ask somebody, so what do you want? That answer comes from the conscious mind, which is creating what it wants for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
But the neuroscientists reveal that the conscious mind only works less than 5% of the day. That most of our behavior is played through the subconscious mind, which is a million times more powerful. Now, here is the problem. The programs in the subconscious mind, the fundamental programs in the subconscious mind, are not ours in the sense that we did not make the programs, the fundamental programs of the subconscious mind. Let me explain how it works. The subconscious mind is, like I said, a jukebox. You push the button and it plays a song or whatever it is. Or let's make it like an iPod. Let's say Eva just gave you a brand new iPod. You open up out of the box and you push play. What do you hear when you do that?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's a question.
I hear blues. But,
well,
seriously.
If you bought a brand new iPod and you push play.
I guess I hear nothing.
You hear nothing. Now, and this is very important because when we're born, the subconscious mind, like an iPod or a jukebox or a machine that makes recordings, has no data in it. You're just born. You got no data in it. So if I asked you if I could, as an infant, one day old, and you've got consciousness, and I said to you, well, think about something. And that infant mind, there's nothing to think about. There's no data. There's nothing there in their programs.
Well, I have a question then.
Yes.
My boyfriend told me an interesting story just an hour ago. He said that when his mother was pregnant with him, that he saw her do something. He saw her put up a toilet roll holder in their bathroom. And he never realized that she was still pregnant with him until a couple of years ago, for whatever reason, he had that memory. And he saw her putting up that toilet paper roll in their bathroom and how she was standing from a third-party perspective.
Yes.
Even though she was still pregnant. Like, when people have near-death experiences and are on the ceiling, it wasn't through her eyes, it was like up on the ceiling. So Where would that information be, or would it not be there when he came in?
Well, there's two ways that information comes in. Number one, as I said, our identity is not inside the cell. Our identity is in the field, like a broadcast, like a television broadcast. Think
mm-hmm.
about it that way.
Okay.
And
so
why I say
observing.
That is, if you don't have a television set, it doesn't mean the broadcast's not there. Broadcast is always there. It's you buy the television set, and you can turn it on or off, so you can see the broadcast. Well, the point is, our spiritual identity is more or less like a broadcast. And that our bodies are like a television set, so we can play. So we're here as part of the medium before we're even born. And then, as importantly, a child, an infant and fetus especially, are linked into the mother's nervous system. What she's responding to, so is the infant, but passively. It's not like the infant's in charge. It's a field effect.
Uh-huh.
And this becomes very important because this is part of the programming that we're going to talk about in the subconscious mind. That says what happened in that fetal developmental period is actually programmed into to that machine subconsciousness, and so those are parts of the experiences, and this is very profound because we now recognize, especially those people associated with pre and perinatal psychology and health, that half of our personality is already formed before we're born based on the experiences in utero.
Wow.
So this becomes very important because it's pretty much left out of most people's pictures of what's going on in their lives. And yet it plays one of the most fundamental roles, and it's a very simple reason, is that the first sensory experiences to be recorded in the mind are the most powerful sensory recordings. And then later on, all the additional ones have less and less power. It's the first time anything happens is like, you know, blows away the machine in a sense. First time you ever experience anything, it's really an opportunity to experience it the most exciting way, because after that you try to re-experience it. You're still comparing it to the first experience.
Okay. So basically, your work says, I think if I understand, that we're conditioned to get our disease, and we get conditioned as far back even as the womb.
That the subconscious mind
uh-huh.
has programs that sabotage and limit us. And this becomes the biggest problem because the programs came from other people. So what the point of that last discussion was is that the first 6 years of your life, the neurological system, the brain, does not operate in consciousness as a you know, predominant brain state. That a child is in a hypnagogic trance, the brain state, the EEG activity of a child's brain until six is not really engaged in consciousness. It's more or less in a hypnotic trance. It's downloading data to put into the program. At six, the brain starts to be able to use consciousness. Now it has data in the program that it can use for consciousness. But so it took the brain and development was really designed to allow about 5 years of programming or so before consciousness kicks in. I mean, the Jesuits are very proud because they knew this and used it, because they would say, give us a child until it's five or six, it'll belong to the church for the rest of its life. They already knew that the first 5 or 6 years are the programs that will primarily shape your life, because those subconscious programs operate 95 to 99% of the day. So now you have a disconnect, and the disconnect is your conscious mind says, I want to heal myself, and your subconscious programming has programs that are sabotaging you. Not good enough, not smart enough, not healthy enough, not deserving enough, not loving enough. These are the kinds of programs that kids get, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
In that time period. And these are the programs that run 95% of the time as we're adults. And then you might say, well, obviously I'm running the program. I should be able to see if I'm sabotaging my life this way. And then comes this very important, profound joke, and that is, you know somebody, and you know their parent, and you recognize that your friend shares the same behavior that their parent has. So one day you just volunteer, and you go, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And the first thing you do is you have to back away from Bill, because he's going to probably jump all over the place and, how can you compare me to my dad? And this is a common enough experience for us, everybody out there.
Mm-hmm.
And why is this relevant? Because listen to the profound nature of why it's relevant. Bill is the only one who doesn't see that he behaves like his dad. Everybody else does. And the reason is this, because he downloads fundamental behaviors by observing his dad. He plays them through the subconscious mind. But when the subconscious mind is playing, it's because the conscious mind's not paying attention. So we rarely see our own subconscious behaviors. And therefore, when they're limiting or sabotaging us, we ourselves are probably the last to even know. And as a result, we don't even know. We sabotage our own desires.
Is there a stronger effect in the child and the mother since the mother carries it?
A stronger effect by the mother?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it has a very profound physiological effect. But then, we can't disconnect the father, because obviously what the father does with the mother and the environment with the mother profoundly influences what the mother's response is. So
mm-hmm.
he's not a disconnected element. He screws up, it really changes everything for the fetus at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually both parents, but the mother is the predominant one. It's her perceptions of life that are translated to this fetus. And here's what's important. The new science, which is described in the book, is a science that shifts us from the concept of genetic control, which means control by genes, to the new evolving science that's really at the leading edge of the forefront of science right now. It's called epigenetic control. And the difference between the two is the prefix epi means above. So if I say epigenetic control, that literally reads control above the genes. Well, this is profoundly different than what I was teaching in medical school, which was called genetic control, control by genes, because if the genes control you, that's where you become the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the new epigenetic control reveals something that's so blow-away exciting. It says that the belief that genes control themselves has been false. We bought into it because we expected it, but ultimately it revealed that this is not the way it works. Genes do not turn on and off. Genes are just simply blueprints. And why that's relevant is because we have given these blueprints so much power and credit for everything. We say, well, the genes did this and the genes did that, as if the gene turns on or turns off as it's frequently described. Here's the issue. A gene is a blueprint to make some of the proteins, which are the body parts that you assemble together to create the physical body. So they're building blocks. The genes are blueprints for the building blocks of the body. Well, the relevance about that is if you take a blueprint to an architect's office, and an architect is working on that blueprint, and you lean over her shoulder and you ask her, is that blueprint on or off? And you'll get such a quizzical look back,
right?
Like, what are you talking about? The blueprint on or off? There is no on and off. And all of a sudden I say, aha. This has been the big upheaval in biology.
Go ahead. I thought I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, okay. I was just saying. So, what the relevance is that the genes are blueprints, and the new control mechanism is recognized to be the perception of the environment, which includes the mind, because the mind makes interpretations of those perceptions. So, basically, it says is, as you perceive the environment, you adjust your biology and your genetics. If you change your perception of the environment, you change your biology and genetics. And why that's relevant is because if genes were controlled, you're a victim. But in epigenetic biology, you have the ability to change your perceptions, and by changing your perceptions, change your biology. So all of a sudden, the new biology switches us from an old belief of victimization to a new belief of mastery, that we actually control it. But then that goes back to your original question, say, what about somebody who can't heal? And then we summarize the whole thing and say, yes, the conscious mind wants to heal, and the perception is that they can heal. And most people's subconscious minds have programs that say you don't heal yourself, that doctors heal you, other professional people heal you, you don't do this yourself. And so now I say I've got two programs, one that says I want to heal, and the other one says I can't heal. And the problem is the subconscious program of can't healing works 95% of the day or more. So the problem is people want to heal with their conscious desires, and their subconscious minds prevent them from getting there. That was a long answer to a relatively short question.
I could ask about 30 questions in there. Just that along, but I want to tell you a couple of things that I want to cover.
Yeah.
So I want to try to get a little bit different information than the usual questions people ask you, to help expand what you're doing.
Yeah.
Now, some of the people that's doing, and so I'm going to tell you two or three things here, and you can pick which one you want to answer first. Some people that are researching consciousness, like Hameroff and that group,
mm-hmm.
you know, they take the position that the mitochondria is the key. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. Then I'd like to know something about the role of hormones and how hormones affect epigenetics.
Okay.
Pharmaceuticals. why they don't work as good as natural medicines.
Yes.
And then one more, let me just look here at my notes. And I have about 30 questions, so we'll run out here.
Okay.
But has there been any new progress made in waveforms as therapeutic agents?
Well, this is at the conventional sense of science.
And genetically modified foods, I'm sorry.
Oh, God, there's, okay. Okay, there's so many of them. Okay, genetically modified foods, we'll go backwards, okay?
Okay.
The problem with genetically modified foods is that the organisms that exist naturally in the environment are all there by their evolution via their cooperation. That all the organisms in the environment are almost like gears engaging with each other with proper meshing of the teeth, and when everything is running smoothly, the machine is just beautiful and it grows. If you put a genetically modified organism in the environment, that's almost the same as altering the gear of that organism. And if you alter the gears to a certain degree, they won't mesh with the rest of the system, and in fact will ultimately distort the rest of the system. So the problems that beface us with genetically modified foods is that they influence the total environment around them, and they may not participate in the way that the natural products do, which is a more harmonious evolution rather than genetic tinkering in a laboratory. Number two about this, in addition to throwing a wrench into the machinery, the genes that are put into genetically modified food are picked up by all other kinds of organisms as well and passed around the entire eco-community. So that what we put into these plants to alter them can, in the end, be modifying all the other organisms in the environment as well. Three, this includes the human, and it's already been demonstrated that, for example, that in our gut are 100 trillion or more bacteria that are required for our survival. We always think of using antibacterials, and this becomes problematic because we will not survive if we don't have the proper bacteria in our digestive system, because they are the interface in the digestion process to allow us to get nutrients. The problem that has now been expressed through genetically modified foods is when that food gets into the digestive system and is being broken down, many of the bacteria in our system can pick up the modified genes and incorporate it into their own genomes. And so the concept or consequence of this is that by eating genetically modified foods, we're also then modifying the terrain, the bacteria that lie in our gut. And this could have profoundly adverse effects on our health, especially if it causes the elimination of necessary bacteria or modifying them to the extent that they become toxic rather than contributing to our health. So genetically modified foods influence the external environment, the world we live in, and they profoundly can influence the internal environment that sustains us inside of our gut, and they can interfere with the environmental machine. So basically, there's not enough research for us to actually dabble in that science, because they're still learning how genes work. So I think this is a fundamental scary situation. Reminds me of Sorcerer's Apprentice with Mickey Mouse. And I wrote that like the scientists are Mickey Mousing around with the genes, and like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, when it went all out of control, you can destroy the whole thing. So I get very nervous about people doing that, and especially because it's now part of an industry and corporate in character. And as soon as it goes corporate in character, it's not scientific anymore, meaning that people are looking for a product to make money, then all the important checks and balances that scientists would normally use would probably be overlooked. And that scares me more, because business has less care than science.
What do you know about Morgallon?
About Morgallon?
Uh-huh.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
So waveforms and biology. Okay. Conventional biology does not recognize energy waves as relevant to biological expression, and that's why conventional biology is connected to the pharmaceutical industry, because to conventional biology, the body is a physical machine, and the only way you can alter the function of that physical machine is with physical things such as drugs. So basically, they look at the body only in a physical character and do not look at or compare it or value it in regard to energy.
quantum physics in 1925 came in and said that the whole belief in a material world is actually totally incorrect because atoms are made out of energy and not made out of particles, and therefore everything that's made out of atoms is made out of energy, and therefore we must incorporate the role of energy entanglement in understanding the expression of matter. The relevance about that is that means that energy fields profoundly affect the biological molecules, especially those that provide for life. Until very recently, this has been a taboo subject for conventional research, and primarily because of the lobbying effect of the pharmaceutical industry, simply because they sell physical drugs and they're not interested in energy healing because it undermines their business model. So the relevance is that medicine, being somewhat in cahoots with the pharmaceutical industry, has avoided looking into the role of energy, and yet recent leading-edge research in biophysics have revealed that the protein molecules that comprise our body and provide for our structure and our behavior, that these protein molecules are profoundly influenced by the quantum mechanical energy field, more so than the presumed interaction with physical matter. In other words, quantum physics was beginning to look at the proteins and recognize that they respond to energy far more effectively than they respond to matter. And as a result, the newest edge, leading edge of science is now beginning to characterize vibrational frequencies that can cause proteins to be turned on and off. Well, this has been the field that people outside of conventional science that have been working with vibrational frequency and electronics and all that have been dabbling with over the years, but the new research, and that's in the conventional realm, by these people working with the vast resources, is really laying a solid foundation to the fact that, yes, the body's chemistry is profoundly influenced by energy fields, and by regulating those fields, you can regulate all aspects of our health and diseases. And most importantly, we also have to recognize that our thought processes and our nervous system's responses to our thoughts also generate such fields that influence the cells, and so that we're really shaped by our mind's ability to create fields and the environmental fields in which we live.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
I hope I can make this clearly, because I'm not a scientist. I have to say it in kindergarten.
All right, that's the way I have to learn it myself, so I can talk with you.
If consciousness is everything that is, and everybody has a different level of consciousness, like David Hawkins' book describes, does that make sense so far?
Well, a little bit. I mean, my first thing is this: everyone has the potential to be equally powerful in their consciousness.
Yeah. But however much it's turned on, however aware they are.
Right.
So, and everything that vibrates has to vibrate at a certain speed to be a certain thing. You know, if you give a light bulb too much energy, it pops. If you don't give it enough, it's not bright enough. Everything needs to be exact. So all these people that are coming up with these frequencies, let's just say maybe somebody says a prostate vibrates at 16,278.68 hertz.
Yeah.
How do these people come up? Because that means if everything's consciousness and everybody has a different level of conscious awareness and everybody's vibrations can be a little bit different. So how do these people come up with such specific vibrations?
Unfortunately, that was the question that I was trying to address when I said that now that conventional science is looking at it with their resources and their instrumentation and their high technology, future numbers might become more real to me. Okay, personally, everybody comes up with these frequency identifications, and now I'm going to say this, so this is off the record and said to the public, that, as you said, consciousness is everything, and that the idea of using these devices and these machines is very nice, and in fact, they may help people, and again, they just as well might hurt people just as much because somebody dials in a frequency. Who knows what the heck that is? I don't know. And the reality is everybody claims, as you said, they have an identity of these frequencies and all that. Basically, if you really just go back to the premise that consciousness is everything, you realize you don't need any machines or any of these things. What you really need to do is just clear up your own consciousness and address it at what you want because when we try to understand the nature of the frequencies, and it's not just a frequency, they're all different pulses and ranges
right.
of activity. I mean, it's so complex that for us to try to figure it out is like, well, that's not likely. But for your mind to figure it out, it is absolutely a reality, because your mind has been doing that before we even knew what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the most important thing that I could see for us to do is to rewrite the limiting programs that most of us got about how we're more or less victims and frail and that we can't control our lives, and rewrite them to recognize that we were programmed not to have power. And this is a very interesting political statement, because it's biopolitics here, and it goes like this. We live in a world that is really based on a hierarchy of power, a lot of powerful people and a whole range down to very unpowerful people, a whole hierarchy of power. And it's interesting because, as I mentioned, when you really understand the nature of biology and consciousness, we're essentially equally powerful in our creative abilities. So a question comes up and says, well, then how did those people get more powerful? And here's the important answer. They didn't get more powerful. They just took away the power from the other people that we have been systematically disempowered to believe we're victims. And as a result of that, we generate industry that supports, the victim belief
mm-hmm.
that we hold. The fact is, we are all very powerful people, but our belief systems, the ones we were programmed with, are disempowering, limiting beliefs. In fact, when I lecture down in Australia and New Zealand, I really like what they come to terms with, what they call cutting the tall poppies. It's something that is done everywhere, but they have a term for it, and it represents this. When a gardener grows poppies and you throw all the seeds in and all the poppies grow up, they all grow up about the same height. Then every now and then, some poppy's head shoots way up over all the other poppies. So the gardener essentially cuts the head off the tall poppies. Well, down under, they use this phrase, cutting the tall poppies, to represent the fact that it's been a process that has gone on for almost ever of raising children in the concept of cutting the tall poppies, meaning when a child starts to show exceptional traits or characters, there's a tendency for the community around to cut the head off that poppy and make them just average. And so this has just been a long, sustained generations and generations passed down of programs of limitation. And the physicists have really come to the forefront and said, look, the world that we experience is a direct consequence of our conscious participation, that we are participants in this world and that our consciousness is influencing the outcome. In fact, Stephen Hawking, the cosmologist guy, he recently had a paper this last year where he actually put into the paper that from his studies that human consciousness changes the unfolding of the cosmos. So basically, the physicists acknowledge our powers. It's we who don't acknowledge our powers. And it's interesting because these powers are really the powers of our beliefs or our disbeliefs of who we are. I mean, I start my lectures and I show people pictures of individuals walking across beds of fire. I show them articles and papers about, like, women lifting cars to get an infant out from under a wreck or something like that. Or I talk to them about people down in the South in the United States that work themselves up into religious ecstasy and drink strychnine to testify that God protects them, and drink it in toxic doses and have no harmful effects. And then you want to say, well, but people walk across the fire, lift the cars, drink the strychnine. Are they different than anybody else? The answer is no. They're the same as everybody else. The only thing that's different is their belief systems in these things are totally unshakable. And it's interesting because I wasn't raised in the Christian tradition. In fact, I avoided spirituality, and that's why I went into science. And yet, it's really interesting because if you go back and just, look at the teachings that are attributed to Jesus, every one of them deals with the fact that you heal yourself through your belief, that you can renew your life through your belief, that beliefs of we could do everything that he did better than he did, but we don't believe it. It's like we've been told this for thousands of years, and the fact is this is actually the bottom line truth. We have bought beliefs that were programmed into our minds before we were conscious that limit us, and then all the rest of our lives, these unconscious beliefs operating 95% of the day function to actually sabotage and limit our expressions and our ability. And because a simple fact is this, the programs in the mind are used to create the reality that we experience. And if your program is one of limitation, then you will manifest a reality of limitation. In contrast, if your program is of exceptional things going on, and you were really programmed that way, then you have a doorway open to you to get to those things. And yet, as I said, almost every one of us grew up in an environment that took away our powers. I mean, think about this. Most people were born with doctors present. That they had seen doctors through their early developmental stages on a continuous basis. That anytime anybody in the family, including themselves, were sick, it was a given that means, oh, somebody's sick, we take them to the doctor. These are programs. Ultimately, what these programs lead to is the simple reality that if you're sick, you don't heal yourself. Somebody else does. So the first thing you've done is you eliminated a natural innate ability to heal yourself until you conform to the program. But here's the joke about that. Many, many people get well on the way to the doctor because once they do the first step, okay, I'm going to the doctor, then the body is ready to do its healing, whether the doctor did anything or not, because we put in the first hurdle that says before we heal, go to the doctor. And it's really wonderful. At least our parents never told us what the doctors had to do, because all you have to do is just show up, and that already initiates the healing process.
I've experienced that before when I was
young. It's very important, because most people have, and they should just recognize it was not a coincidence, an accident, or anything like that. It is a reflection of a fact that we have an innate ability to heal ourselves. We've always had that. There were people here for millions of years before there were medical schools, and they were able to heal themselves. And our limitations are more or less our belief systems. In fact, even medicine has written and acknowledged that one-third, and that's the minimum, to up to two-thirds of all healing, drugs, surgery, etc., are all due to the placebo effect. And the placebo effect is essentially mind over matter. And more of that could happen, except that nobody studies the placebo effect and nobody encourages the placebo effect, and yet it's built into every one of us. So, and the simple reason why is if you heal yourself, then the corporate market for selling drugs is going to be affected.
So now I have another question.
Yes.
I have two questions. One is...
We're going all over tonight, aren't we? That's okay. Can't get bored. The subject's changing every few minutes.
One, I want to know... I want the second question answered first, but I don't want to forget this one. When are they going to start teaching this to our children? My children's science teacher, I have a second grader and a ninth grader.
Mm-hmm.
Their teachers have no idea what we're talking about.
Absolutely not. Nope. There's a problem, and the problem is this. Textbooks are a minimum of 10 to 15 years behind accepted leading research. So that means if any research was just about 10 or 15 years ago, which is epigenetics,
uh-huh,
it's not even in the textbooks, and it'll take a few more years before it gets there. But beginning to see epigenetic articles and things like Discover Magazine, Scientific American, you know, so that there's an interface, even Time Magazine and Newsweek have been having articles about epigenetics where changing the environment changes the genes, and it's really important. But this insight is, to me, very exciting because it changes civilization. It changes us from the belief that we're these victims to the belief that we control our lives, and that's going to change everything, especially in a world like the United States where healthcare costs are sinking the ship under these massive costs, which are totally unnecessary. So I look forward to this information to come in textbook because it'll save us.
Okay,
that was question one. Now I know you want question two.
I've got two and one. For people who are really conscious, and I'll use myself as an example, I know what you're saying. I had a spiritual epiphany. I try to live in the moment. I'm awake, and I understand that I have programmed thoughts running across my mind all the time.
Yes.
And I ignore them. I mean, I'll do something as drastic as get a toothbrush and clean the grout in my tile to stop thinking. Okay?
Yes. But it doesn't mean that the body is not responding to it just because you consciously decided not to listen to the volume. And this becomes very critical because there's no such thing as I'm ignoring it. Is because you're just saying I'm not listening to it, but doesn't mean it's not there.
Okay, that was where I was going.
Yeah, the cells are continuously hearing that story whether you wanted to listen to it or not.
How do you fix that?
What's that?
How do you fix that? Say, I have depression issues sometimes, or
yeah.
I think I have some heart disease issues that may be coming, but particularly the depression issues. I ignore it, and I'll go off my antidepressant and try to be in the moment
yeah. And
only have positive thoughts, but sure enough, if I don't take that antidepressant, 3 or 4 months down the road, here it comes.
Yeah, because...
How do you fix that?
Because this is the problem, and it relates to the previous stuff about the two minds, conscious and subconscious, and the two programs, I mean, the programs that are primarily in the subconscious, remember, we got them from our parents, our siblings, our community, etc., and they don't necessarily agree with the programs in your conscious mind, which is the one that says, listen, I don't want this stuff, and I don't need this stuff, and I'd rather just go along and forget about it and just have this life. That's really cool, except that mind only works, controls it about 5% of the time. So
I work hard at it, though, Bruce.
Well, it works, you know, and it all depends on the motivation. There's other things. I want to get back to that because remind me to talk about the honeymoon effect.
Okay, well, let's see how much time we got. We got 15 minutes.
Okay. So
and he'll
here's
cut us off.
First issue is this. We have the beliefs in the subconscious which are programmed in there, and your conscious mind was the one that said, look, I don't want to deal with this. So you don't want to deal with it. That means you're not paying attention. Well, I'd rather pay attention if I'm brushing the grout. Okay, well, that's really cool. But that means you're ignoring everything else. And here's what the problem is. The nature of the subconscious mind is to control every function that you're not paying attention to. And they're very complex things. So, for example, let's say you're driving the car, you're driving, and you have some friend in the passenger seat, and you get in such a wonderful discussion. You're so preoccupied in the discussion, you drive without realizing you haven't looked at the street. That at some point you look out the window and it dawns on you, you really haven't paid any attention. And the fact is, well, that's not a problem because the subconscious mind is a million times more powerful than the conscious mind, drive the car better than you anyway. But the reality is, here's what's the important point. When the car was being driven by the subconscious mind because you were in the discussion, you can't tell me about the what was going on, you know, what was going on during the drive. You weren't paying attention. And so consequently, the subconscious mind was running all the rest of the show. So you can say, I'm going to focus on this grout, and that's really cool. But the subconscious mind is still running everything else, all the rest of the emotions and things that are going on in the body with you at the control saying, I'm not listening. And the issue is, it doesn't make a difference you're listening or not, because the function of the thing is actually it works more when you're not listening.
Okay.
And so the important understanding, and this is where the big failure at some point has been with psychology, is that it was always assumed at some degree that if you become consciously aware, so your conscious mind now becomes aware of the programs that you have that you don't like or what, you know, led to the programs, your mom did this, your dad did that, whatever, your conscious mind's fully aware, it doesn't change your behavior. And this is the problem. All that psychoanalysis, people still end up with the same behavior anyway most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue about that is because this is the disconnect. The belief that the conscious mind's awareness will leak into the subconscious and change it is fallacious because the two are separate entities. That the conscious mind has you as an entity in it, and the subconscious mind's a machine. There's nobody in there. So trying to talk to the subconscious, you know, over time by saying, well, I don't like this behavior, and we should change this, and let's work on this, and we're going to fix this, is not very effective. I mean, in a real regimented sense, and mantras, and putting it into habituation practices, you can influence it, but there are better ways to do it. Yet the reality is this. Most people just give, you know, that lip service to their subconscious mind saying, oh, listen, don't do this anymore. I'm tired of this, and let's change that, and let's lose weight, or let's be happier, or let's do these things. And that's the conscious mind talking. And the problem is, if you found yourself in the subconscious mind, you realize there's nobody in there that's listening to it. It's because it's a machine, and it doesn't learn that way. And so it becomes very ineffective to try to hold a dialogue with yourself to rewrite these programs, because that's not the way it works. It's like a record playback device. And to make it work, you can't ignore a behavior, because you're just consciously ignoring behavior. The subconscious is still playing the behavior whether you paid attention to it or not. And that becomes where it gets worse, because then it's really undermining us without us paying any attention at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are ways to get around that. That's, I have listed on my website resources of different ways of programming that subconscious mind, because it's programmable. But you have to recognize it's programmable through a process. It's not programmable by, like, I have a microphone and I'm going to talk into it right now and it's going to listen to me. That's not happening that way. But there are ways to reprogram it very rapidly. In fact, in minutes, if you know how to push the record
like
button.
Like EFT and things like that.
Some of those energy psychologies, yeah, they're very effective. And basically, it's really one sense of engaging what is called super learning. And super learning, here's what super learning is compared to the way us adults conventionally learn, which is very slow and hard. Super learning, imagine a three-year-old kid. A three-year-old kid in a family can pick up three languages at the same time and learn them all and keep all their grammar and vocabulary and syntax separate and identifiable as each language. Instantaneously, in a sense, and yet when a child gets to be 8 or 9, you try to teach it one new language. And all of a sudden, it's a very difficult issue. And that's because, remember I said the first 5 or 6 years is this download process. And that's a super learning thing where you just experience it and it's downloaded. Experience it and it's downloaded. But this changes as we get older, and it has to do with brain function. And you can increase your ability to super learning, but there are exercises that do that, which are really exercises that get a greater coherence of function between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere of the brain, because under normal circumstances, during part of the day we're more right hemisphere, and then sometimes during the day we're more left hemisphere, and then it switches back and forth. But being coherent in both hemispheres, that was in the early phase of our life before 5, and yet you can recapture that learning experience in super learning. And the relevance is, just like an infant, you can hear it and put it right into the program in a super learning state, and it's reprogrammed. So some of the energy psychologies invoke that kind of process and facilitate super learning.
I'm glad to understand that now.
Well, it's very important, because what you're really trying to do is get brain balance with a program. You can't just, you know, if you put it in the left hemisphere, that's the logical side. If you put it in the right hemisphere, that's the emotional side. And when you put it in both, you deal with logic and emotion, and the whole picture makes sense. But if you're operating in a conventional adult state, you're either in your logical side or your emotional side, but not in both, generally. So that means you might be working today on some emotion, but it didn't change the logic of the programming. Or you might be logically working on the program, but it doesn't change the emotion of the program, so therefore it's an incomplete process, so to speak.
Gotcha. Okay, you got 2 minutes to tell where they can find you again, what your book is.
Well, the book is The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Nobles and regular bookstores everywhere. And it's quite readable and accessible. That was the design of the book, so that it covers some very interesting science, but it's really for non-science people.
It's on CD, too, isn't it?
What's that?
Because I heard it, CD.
Oh, there's some CDs out from Sounds True, and one of them won a number of awards, but I've never listened to it myself, so I can't vouch for it.
It was good.
I every time I listen to my own recording, it makes me cringe a bit, so... but it was called Wisdom of the Cells,
I thought I had Biology of Belief.
That's a short version. That's okay. a three-disc set, and this other one is 6, 7, or 8 CDs or something like that. It's like a course in itself. And it really explains this, because what I'm offering is not a self-help book. That's really important, because people used to say, this book is a lousy self-help book, and I say, well, geez, I agree with you, because it never was a self-help book. It's a book about knowledge of self, and knowledge is power. So basically, this is self-power or self-empowering. That's what the book is. It's not steps and routines and things to do. It's to give you a fundamental knowledge of who you are and how you work. And you can get a lot of this information just from articles that are on my website, brucelipton.com, without buying the book. So and there's a lot of stuff on YouTube. So that's what I just recognized. So there are varieties of ways of getting this information into your house.
It's worth it to buy the book. Now, there's a lot of... I require scientific information to believe it, because there's so many things out there you don't know what to believe.
Yeah, well...
This book gives it to you.
Yeah, well, that was my intention. That was my intention.
It's a good book. It's worth the going out and paying for it.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Eva.
Okay, my dear. Thank you for
I hope that we, you know, I mean, I could just realize, boy, that was like a pinball game where the ball bounced from side to side. But I hope it, in some sense it was something that touched somebody's interest. And I appreciate the audience. And I really hope that you can get a grasp of this, dear audience, because we are so powerful and have to relearn that.
We are, and I thank you.
Thank you, Eva.
I hope you'll come back because I've got 50 more questions on different topics.
I would love to.
Good night, dear.
Good night.
Bye-bye.